hello and welcome to Here in LA, Franklin Hills edition. Today we talk with Paul Haddad. Paul wrote one of my favorite new books, Inventing Paradise. I love it because he teaches us about the six most important patriarchs of LA, dudes whose names you see on street signs and freeway exits, but you'd never hear about it in our beautiful schools. We'll chat about Mr. Mulholland, General Sherman, Mr. Huntington, two LA Times leaders, and the man who gave us the Port of LA, all of which turned LA from a normal dusty town in the 1880s to the second largest U.S. city in just the 1920s. It's a fascinating read, which you can also hear on quote-unquote tape, if you like. If you do get the audiobook, Paul himself reads it to you. So now, here with us for the second time. He has moved since we first met him to answer questions that I have about his book. Plus, he'll tell us what it's like to live in a storybook house in Franklin Hills. Here's Paul Haddad. Hey, everybody. I am here in Franklin Hills with Paul Haddad.
Hey! You got it. Or Haddad.
How am I supposed to say it?
You said Haddad.
Is it? You just had dad.
Right.
Boom, boom.
Boom, boom. 1, 2.
Okay, everybody. We are here in Paul's amazing storybook house. We're in, I guess this would be a man cave in any other world, but I feel like you love your wife. You don't need to escape her.
Yeah, it's a marital cave.
She spends time down here playing skee-ball and...
Yeah, my kids kind of co-opted the space, and then they just went off to college. So it's back to a man and woman cave.
So I remember your daughter was at UCLA.
Yeah.
Where's your son?
He just started freshman year at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo.
They both stayed in California.
Yeah.
They must love you.
And public schools. I love them. Public universities.
Wow. You know what's crazy is even though I went to Santa Barbara, I never went to SLO, ever.
Wow. It's only like 90 minutes north.
Yeah.
Well, you know, people go to UCSB because it was just declared the number one party school in America.
For the third year in a row, I understand.
Ooh.
Which I'm still unsure. They don't seem to party the way we did. But good for them.
Good for them.
Everything is relative, I guess. Paul, we're here because you wrote an amazing book. Let me get the book. To get me to read a book is a very hard thing to do. I read about one a year. I mean, I listen to books a little bit, and I listen to yours, too. But it's good to have the book because you have so many details compressed in here that it's like every 2 minutes, there's more and more and more going on. And so the book is called Inventing Paradise, and it was published by Santa Monica Press. Where's Santa Monica Press?
They used to be in Santa Monica. Now they're located in Solano Beach.
Where's Solano Beach?
Near San Diego.
Way down there.
Yeah, but you know you can publish from anywhere now. Mm-hmm. The publisher, Jeffrey Goldman, is he's from L.A. and knows Southern California and puts out a lot of books on Los Angeles, including Secret Stairs.
Oh, so you've worked with him before?
Yes, I worked with him on my book, 10,000 Steps a Day in L.A., which is kind of a companion to this other book that they already had, Secret Stairs, and then Freewaytopia, How Freeway Shaped Los Angeles. And my first book, my Dodger book, was with him. So this was my fourth go-around.
I like it when people like working together.
Yeah, it's a good team.
Okay, so the reason I love this book so much is you taught me a lot. And you basically base it around a half dozen white dudes from about 1880 till about 1920, would you say?
Correct.
And these are people that I've seen their names on street signs and stuff, but I never knew their real stories. And so I'm going to pop quiz myself here. Mulholland? What's Mulholland's first name? Walter?
William Mulholland.
William Mulholland. We've got Moses Sherman.
Yep.
We got the publisher of the Times, Chandler.
Correct.
Happy Chandler?
Harry Chandler.
Harry Chandler. Who else am I missing?
And then his father-in-law,
Otis?
Harrison Gray Otis.
Right.
Correct. And Phineas Banning.
Banning.
Yeah.
Because Banning made the ports.
Right. Exactly. The Port of Los Angeles. And the last one is Henry Huntington.
Henry Huntington.
Yeah.
Was there a lot written about Banning in your book? I don't remember too much about him.
Only the first chapter, and then I reference him again later because he did establish the Port of Los Angeles and the link, the first railroad in Southern California that linked the harbor with downtown LA. So that allowed for a lot of trade and helped establish the Shoestring Strip, all that whole strip going down to the harbor.
Right. Okay. So what was kind of fascinating to me, soaking in this whole book, is it felt like... Well, first of all, it was interesting that not all these guys were rich, because I was under the assumption that founding fathers are usually rich dudes who exploit their wealth to the natives or onto the natives. And that's not necessarily the case here.
Well, it was the case for most of them. The only one who was not rich in as far as like a tycoon was William Mulholland.
Right.
The others weren't that rich in the beginning, and they were filing for bankruptcy every other year. But once they got traction in their various industries, be it rail, real estate, what have you, they became pretty wealthy.
And so what was also interesting to me is it felt like all of these six dudes all had an expertise in something that complemented everybody else. So kind of like what you were talking about, one guy was really good with real estate. Another guy was great with trains. Mulholland was this weird genius about water. And at that particular era of LA, all of those things were very valuable to know about.
They were. And to actually back up what you're saying, none of them came from money. The only one who did was Henry Huntington. He had a very rich uncle who took him under his wing, and he was already kind of swimming in millions of dollars by his 20s,
right.
Huntington. But the rest, yes, they were completely self-made men during the Gilded Age, that's what it was all about, was taking risks. And they all pursued these different avenues, which helped grow Los Angeles.
So if I almost feel like if one of these people weren't there, it still might have worked.
Yeah.
Except for Mulholland. I feel like the way at least you portray him as this guy with this photogenic memory, mm-hmm. who can recall where fire hydrants are in the city, like at a moment's notice.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for him, then, I mean, obviously LA would have happened, but maybe it would have been slower and maybe LA wouldn't have been as large. Would you agree?
I do. I think that what he brought to the table was an engineering expertise with water. As you said, he had a photogenic memory of where thousands of subterranean pipes were and pumping stations.
Crazy.
And fire hydrants. Yeah, he was kind of a savant when it came to that.
Mm-hmm.
And though it wasn't his idea to get water from Northern California and to build the aqueduct, he was the person who implemented it and had the knowledge as to how to do it. And he helped raise the ceiling of LA's population from 300,000 that could survive just from water from the LA River and various wells to about 2 to 3 million just by building the aqueduct. He raised the capacity for the people who could live here. And then it went even higher when he helped design the Colorado River Aqueduct and various others.
Let's continue with Mulholland real quick, because when I was almost finished with this book, I was like, Mulholland needs a movie. Has there been a movie about him?
Chinatown is the closest we've gotten.
Okay. And that's another thing that this book taught me, which was Chinatown is wrong.
Yeah. It's a great piece of fiction, but it's inspired by actual events.
Has this always been, did everybody always know that?
People in the know that, but many, many audiences, I feel, think that it's an actual depiction of how life was in Los Angeles and how we got the water, and it's not.
Right.
Yeah.
And yet it wins Best Picture.
Yeah. It's a piece of entertainment, but it is inspired by real events and real people. There's the water expert in that movie is Mul Ray. That's informed by Mulholland. And then the John Huston character is this... very towering, gregarious, profane guy, a patriarch. His personality was modeled after Mulholland because he was that way with very salty language. Mm-hmm. But Mulholland was, he wasn't the power broker that John Huston's character is, who also, there's the whole incense subplot and everything. Mulholland was a worker. You know, he wanted to be a good guy. Robert Towne, I read that he actually based that character, John Huston's character, he based that character on Harry Chandler.
Right.
And so, but Chandler was a very reserved person in real life. He didn't have the outgoing personality like John Huston's character. So mm-hmm. it was kind of an amalgam of things.
I mean, maybe they all need their own movies. Maybe this needs to be a 6-part Netflix special about the Godfathers of L.A. Because they're all very, very interesting people.
Yeah, very flawed also.
Super flawed.
Yeah.
And, for example, Chandler. Okay, so maybe he wasn't born into money, but he did the right... He married the right girl.
He definitely... And he also... I think he would have been successful even had he not married her, his mm-hmm. boss's daughter. His boss was the publisher of the LA Times.
Right.
Yeah. Chandler just had a knack for money and opportunity, and he was very self-serving. He found very creative ways to enrich himself. My favorite is that he was the circulation manager, or he managed the deliveries of the LA Times. That was his entry-level job when he was 22, 23 years old. He'd come out here because he had tuberculosis or a respiratory illness back east, and he was going to die unless he came to the dry weather of L.A. And when he got a job at the Times, he realized very quickly that there were other newspapers that needed delivery managers. There was the L.A. Chronicle, the L.A. Express. And so he took over those jobs as well. And he was skimming money. He was making money off those circulations, those deliveries. And then he got all the workers who deliver the papers drunk at like different retreats. He would take them up to Big Bear. They would miss their deliveries. He would, you know, make sure that they were not reliably delivering their newspapers by entertaining them. And so those several of those papers went under. They just didn't survive because Chandler was undermining them as he was getting money from them, which then upped the delivery for the LA Times, which was even more money in Chandler's pocket. And my favorite part of that story is when his father-in-law, Harrison Gray Otis, who owned the Times, found out that Chandler was engaged in the scheme. He got very upset at Harry, not because of his scheming actions of putting these other papers out of business, but because he didn't give him some of the money as well. General Otis.
A man who is never a general.
Yeah, never a general. I want to be Colonel Haddad from now on. You know, I love the honorifics tossed around there. There was a General Moses Sherman, which, you know, wink, wink, is like General Sherman, you know, so from the Civil War. So, yeah.
Let's skip over to Sherman real quick, too. What I loved about his story was near the end, where... He owned what is now West Hollywood. Mm-hmm. But it was obvious that West Hollywood was not going to be part of LA. And so he took up, I guess, Sherman Oaks. But mm-hmm. but to me, what's so interesting about that is LA would be so much different if West Hollywood had gone the way of LA. Because of all those nightclubs and all that nightlife, it's still like the biggest nightlife after midnight in all of LA. And I don't think it would have if Sherman had had his way.
You're right. It's that kind of parallel lives, sliding doors moment in LA history. Because in 1924 or so, West Hollywood was called Sherman, as you said. It'd be like naming a town Pierce. Why not?
Right.
These guys had egos that were run amok. But they wanted to change their name. They wanted to either be East Beverly Hills and glom off the allure of Beverly Hills or West Hollywood. So they chose West Hollywood. They put it to a vote. They did not merge with LA. It was a very close vote. They needed some water. That's why they wanted to merge with LA. But instead, they worked out a deal with Beverly Hills. And so it remained in unincorporated area, county land, which was where vice was flourishing and where mobsters set up clubs in the 30s and 40s. And you had, you know, sex workers and you had gambling and back rooms. And that's in the DNA of West Hollywood, as is tolerance for any kind of stripe of person you want to be. And so that is good for modern day West Hollywood, which certainly would have been neutered and all that would have gone away if it became part of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. It would not have stood for that.
Let's skip over to, we'll talk about the other three guys in a second, but let's talk about water real quick since you bring it up like this. A thing that I loved about your book was I think it explained to me why LA is as big as it is. Because it shouldn't be this giant. It should have been broken up into lots of different cities and maybe a couple of different counties. But the reason I feel that you're teaching us through this book is these founders wanted it to be huge because the more people, the more tax dollars, but also the more water they could sell to these people because that was a rare thing in this particular region, this geographic region. And the more cities that they could strong arm into being part of LA, the bigger LA grew, and it grew very fast.
That's correct. The Los Angeles Aqueduct, which opened in 1913, was both a blessing and a curse. It was obviously a curse for people up north who lived in Owens Valley. Their water was taken under very duplicitous means. So that was bad. It was good, of course, for Los Angeles, but it was also a curse for Los Angeles because LA had taken out a $23 million bond, which was a lot of money then. And the only way to pay down that bond was to bring in more people into the city, as you alluded to. So you needed to increase the tax rolls. You needed to absorb more communities, whether they liked it or not. And so LA's charter in the 19-teens implemented a law that said, if you want to merge with us, I'm sorry, if you want to access our water from the aqueduct, then you need to consolidate with Los Angeles. And that's the only way you're going to get it. Otherwise, you're on your own. And of course, many of these little standalone cities like Palms or Mar Vista, you know, they were their own little towns. They couldn't go on go alone. You know, even Venice had a lot of wells and didn't join LA to the 20s until those wells dried up. And so they were strong-armed into joining Los Angeles if they wanted the water.
You know, that brings up a question I had because it's fascinating to me what cities remain cities. And some of them make sense, like Santa Monica makes sense, Malibu, because I imagine those Santa Monica mountains were able to give them fresh water. Am I wrong?
Well, Hollywood is an example of that. Hollywood is actually at the foothills of the Santa Monica Mountains, Griffith mm-hmm. Park, which is the eastern flank of the Santa Monica Mountains. And there was water, and remains to this day by Ferndale, there is water coming through the hills there. Yeah. So yeah, they were able to establish their own little water company. I think it was called the Union Water Company. And from 1903 to 1910, Hollywood was its own city. But it kept growing, as many of these towns did. And some of them grew pretty big, like Pasadena or Santa Monica. And they did really have a problem anticipating future growth, knowing that they needed water. What saved them and from joining Los Angeles and to retain their autonomy was the Metropolitan Water District. And that was an agency that was formed in the mid-20s that said, look, if you want to tap into our agency and get water from Owens River and soon the Colorado River, you pay your pro forma share and we'll give you the water. And so among the first cities to sign up for that plan were Pasadena, Santa Monica, Burbank, all these towns that wanted to remain independent, and that saved them from having to join Los Angeles. And so pretty much the growth of LA expanding its borders stopped around that time by the early 30s.
So the Metro Water Association,
which is still around, MTD.
How were they able to get
MWD? Excuse me.
How were they able to get the Owens Valley water too? The Chandlers and those people didn't have a.
You know what? That's a really good question. I believe they acquired access to the Los Angeles Aqueduct later. Where they initially got their water was the Colorado River Aqueduct. Mm-hmm. Now, I think they might have swung a deal with Los Angeles to, you know, they paid them to get some of the water in the interim from the Los Angeles Aqueduct because the Colorado River one wasn't ready until the late 30s, early 40s. And then there was an extension to Mono Lake from the Los Angeles Aqueduct. That was another source of water. Mm-hmm. And by that point, LA did not want to even manage its own water anymore. It was getting too expensive. Mm-hmm. So LA then decided to join the Metropolitan Water District as another city that would get its water from that agency.
Oh.
Yeah.
Let's go back real quick to Owens Valley, because in your book, you talk about how these farmers just thought that they had just ripped off these rich LA guys by offering them three times the price for their land and their water rights. Didn't they make a lot of money, these farmers?
They did, but they wouldn't have agreed to sell their land for three times what it was worth if they knew their land was going to be used for so that LA could buy it up and build an aqueduct there. So they felt they were tricked. They were betrayed by not just Los Angeles, but also by the federal government. There was a reclamation agent, Lippincott, Joseph Lippincott, who they later, the Owens Valley folks called him Judas Lippincott, because he was supposed to help them save their farms and get them water. Mm-hmm. And he ended up working on the side with Los Angeles and helping grease the wheels to get them, the people up north, to sell their water to Los Angeles. Fred Eaton was a former mayor who was also a water engineer who worked with Mulholland. It was Eaton's idea to kind of go up there posing as someone looking to buy stock land, you know, cattle land. That's what he told all the Owens Valley farmers. So they thought, oh, okay, there'll still be water here for us if we want to buy some other land and raise our crops elsewhere. I'll sell this land for this guy who wants it three times more than what it's worth. But not only did they use it for the aqueduct, but they made the whole valley up there fallow. So they couldn't even, these folks who lived up there couldn't even build farms somewhere else. So it was a double whammy on them.
And they made it fallow by pumping too much water out of these reserves?
By taking all the snowmelt from the Sierra Nevada and funneling it into the Los Angeles Aqueduct and draining Owens River, which is what really was the kind of the reservoir, the natural lake that was formed from the snowmelt. It just pumped it right out of the lake.
So, again, this is all news to me. I'm a dummy from Illinois. What do I know? But when I drive up the 5, I feel like those farmers are there and there's cattle being raised. Are they buying it back from LA at a high price? How are they able to survive?
Well, when you're driving up the 5, you're mostly looking at there's another reservoir, aqueduct that was built later, part of the state water project, like I think in the 70s. So when you see that aqueduct from the 5 and you're going north of Bakersfield and when you're in the San Joaquin Valley, that's a different reservoir. The original Los Angeles reservoir was east of that, some of it, you know, traversing 395. And yes, much of it is very fertile as you drive up to Mammoth and Independence and Bishop and all these towns up there, kind of where the source of the aqueduct, you know, started. But if you compare it to how things were then, none of those towns were able to really grow wealthy because of the actions of people in Los Angeles.
So it's still hurting those places.
It is. It's still a raw point, also because of the pollution up there now. Without having water in the lake bed, it's spreading toxins all over the place. It's one of the most unhealthy areas, much like the Salton Sea, as that's being drained near the Mexico-California border, like Brawley, El Centro, another area in Los Angeles where asthmatic rates are higher, respiratory illnesses. You get that in the Owens Valley area. So Los Angeles has had to make reparations, pump some water back to help dissipate some of the dust or tamp it down. So it remains a problem, and it's been litigious over the decades.
So when I see, okay, so in LA County, there's 88 cities or 89, something like that.
Yeah.
And LA is one of them.
Yeah.
LA is obviously the biggest one. So those 87 others, I'm thinking cities like Culver City, you mentioned Pasadena, but like Burbank, Glendale. Mm-hmm. Should I just imagine that the reasons that they were able to remain their own independent cities is they all got their water from this metropolitan water source?
Most of them. The city of San Fernando, and it is its own little city, San Fernando, even though the entire valley is named after that, yet it's its own little city. They actually got all of their water from, I guess, these just really well-plenished wells as recently as 2019. Other years,
so
they've had import
table
water.
Underneath,
yes,
the city of San Fernando.
Yeah, because the city is, I think it's only 3 square miles. It's actually pretty small as cities go. So it was one of the rare municipalities who was able to still access its own water.
I love that you taught me about the Venice canals.
I taught myself about it in my research. I grew up in LA and I thought I knew the whole story of the Venice canals and Venice in general.
So what did you learn?
Well, I learned that the Venice Beach that we all know and love was not the first Venice Beach in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
That Moses Sherman created the first one 2 years earlier. Mm-hmm. That was shocking to me. Now, I should have been hip to that because of the 8 canals that still exist in Venice, one of them is called Sherman Canal.
Mm-hmm.
And then the others are named after his little real estate buddies. And they created those canals in 1903 as part of a millionaire's colony, they called it. So he built it for wealthy people. And Abbot Kinney Boulevard, you know, we all know Abbot Kinney is the founder of Venice. He got the idea from Moses Sherman and also like the World's Fair in Chicago. Like the Venice canals were a big deal then. Everybody wanted to replicate them, I guess. Even Huntington built his own version, Naples, down in Long Beach that has canals around the same time. And so Abbot Kinney built canals that were really more for the working man, for the middle class. And it was 3 miles worth of canals. And it had an amusement zone, but also like symposiums and health lecture halls, you know, where it was kind of new agey for its time, where adults who wanted to, you know, learn about longevity or any of those utopian ideas of the era could go to Venice also. But what really took off were all the rides and amusement parks and pleasure piers. Mm-hmm. And that lasted until the 20s when Venice had to, you know, merge with Los Angeles because it was going bankrupt, essentially, the town. And LA thought that the canals were kind of fetid and stinky, and they had seen their best days, and so they paved over all of them, leaving only the 8 canals from the original Venice owned by Sherman. So that's the part of Venice now that we associate with the canals. Abbot Kinney's canals are all gone.
So Sherman came first with his canals.
Yeah.
Abbot Kinney kind of... 2 years later. Rip it off, but
2 years later, like 1905.
But competed with it by making a bigger version of it.
Yeah.
Carnival based almost.
Mm-hmm.
And the OG remains.
Yeah, exactly.
And talk about, and those are rich people. His dream has come true.
Yeah. And you know what? You're right. And also, Sherman, the thing that is also that was a little lost on me until I started researching the book was that Moses Sherman helped develop the entire West Side. We don't associate him with the West Side.
That's right.
He built a whole streetcar empire that went from downtown LA to the beach communities. So he had a head start on Abbot Kinney.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to establish Playa del Rey and Palms and his version of Venice. And he built an entire circular railroad track. If you looked overhead, it looked like a giant balloon that started in LA. It went down the coast from Santa Monica down to Playa del Rey and then back. It was a 100-mile track called the Balloon Route. And people could take it for sightseeing trips or to visit these lots that were owned, of course, by Sherman, all on the West Side, which was vacant land then, a bunch of, you know, Bologna Creek, and it was kind of the hinterlands. But he was smart enough to realize the growth of LA was going to move toward the beach.
Right.
Everyone loves the beach. And Santa Monica had already been established, so he had he was onto a good idea. So he really helped be the pioneer for the westward expansion of LA.
Did he have his own money in order to finance this? Because I can't see a board of directors who are like, you want us to give you how much money for a rail line that goes to a desert place?
Yeah, he was one of the more unlikely moguls of his time because he was a school teacher in Phoenix up until 1890. And nothing in his past would indicate that he'd turn into this multimillionaire baron of streetcars and real estate. And he was really like Harry Chandler's right-hand man. The two of them made a killing in real estate later on. But what he did do to expand his rail empire, Sherman, was he would charge a tax, a subscription rate, for anyone who lived along his rail lines who wanted the benefit of these, you know, trolleys going past their lots to entice people to buy their properties that, you know, these subdividers were developing. And so that's one way that Moses Sherman was able to make money. It was almost like extortion. Like, you want this track to go buy your property? You got to give me some money every month. So he made some money that way, and also by buying his own land and having the railways go to his own properties, as Huntington did later.
So he shook them down before the rails were built?
Correct.
And said, I'm gonna do this to Playa.
Mm-hmm.
but you're going to have to pay me a little.
Yeah.
And these people are like, fine with us.
Yeah.
None of us have cars, right?
Correct. It wasn't even, I think at the time, it wasn't regarded so much as a shakedown because LA was trying to grow and grow fast. And they wanted people to move here and live here. And so there wasn't enough public funds to grow railways into hundreds of miles of track. So you turn to the private sector. So they were grateful for people like Sherman and Huntington to build these tracks everywhere, even if it was kind of self-serving. Mm-hmm. And they were benefiting from it because a rising tide raises all boats.
City is another place that, talk about circus. I didn't know anything about this place.
That should be a movie, or at least the next American, what do you call it? Horror.
Yeah.
Yeah. That anthology series.
Yeah.
It existed. Barn City existed near today's Culver City. And it was a small little city that wasn't really serving. It did have maybe a population of about 4,000 or 5,000 people, mm-hmm. but half of them worked for the Barnes Circus. And Barnes was the, it was a big circus then, much like Barnum and Bailey or Ringling Brothers. And so what Barnes wanted to do as the owner of Barnes City, and he put his brother in charge as the mayor, was to have like a tax shelter. So he created this little municipality, called it Barnes City. And it was really, it sounds like it was a very colorful place. There were circus animals all over the place. MGM was at Culver City or early versions of it. A lot of studios were setting up shop there. If they needed primates or animals for their movies, they would just call Barnes or, you know, rent some of his animals. Abbot Kinney actually put up the Barnes Circus every winter. He would have them perform in Venice. That was one way to make money. Mm-hmm. Barnes himself, all his trains, when he traveled across the country, he'd advertise LA, come to Los Angeles, sunshine, come to Barnes City, check out our circus. So it was kind of this racket. And what happened was it was in a prime spot there when LA was expanding. LA wanted to absorb it, and Barnes City didn't want to sell itself to LA. And during the actual vote as to whether Barnes City was going to annex with Los Angeles, apparently there were monkeys voting in cages. And they put a pen in their hands and they would, you know, say, we don't want to annex. And so the city got sued, and it went up to the California Supreme Court, which decided, yeah, there's too much, excuse the phrase, too much monkey business going on here. You need to unincorporate. And so they did. It lasted 8 months, and then LA quickly swooped in and took over the town.
This was one of my favorite stories because I'd never heard of any of this. And for sure, I mean, monkeys are always going to make me laugh. But monkeys voting is the current day Republicans' biggest
right?
nightmare that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
But it actually did exist in LA back then.
That, and also a lot of, you know, a lot of circus workers are transients. They don't live in any one place. Mm-hmm. They're unhoused, but they're working seasonally for the circus. So many of them did not live in LA, and they were voting. They were not registered voters.
Right.
So if you check the voting records, they did not live here. They did not have a right to vote. And it was the non-circus citizens, the ones who did not work for the circus, who lived in Barnes City, who then petitioned and sued them and eventually won out.
This would be a great movie.
Oh, amazing. Surprised it hasn't been done.
Or even a short. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, maybe a whole movie.
Good
too.
Podcast.
Well, but I want to see all this.
I know. Exactly. It's very visual.
Is there any remaining elements of Barnes City in Culver City right now?
None.
Nothing.
Nothing. He actually took his whole entourage and moved to Baldwin Park later.
Okay.
Yeah. So that maybe there's something out there. I don't know.
Right. No, I love that one. That was really awesome. A lot of your research seems to come from old versions of the LA Times. And what I love about this book is something that I learned when I worked there, which was the idea that the LA Times is this liberal bastion is foolish. And the only time that it could even be considered leaning left is maybe in the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. But for the most part of its, what is it, 140 years old?
Yeah, about
something
that.
Something like
yep.
that. History, it was staunch Republican, anti-union, anti-people, like pro-business to its teeth. And I think your book really brings that out a lot. And not only that, but you remind us that there used to be more than one newspaper in LA.
Yeah.
And often they would tell the story better than the LA Times regarding things like Otis and Chandler.
Yeah, the LA Times, no question, was a mouthpiece for Republican talking points and the Republican leadership of the Times, Harry Chandler and his father-in-law, Harrison Gray Otis. And as you said, they were very anti-labor. The other newspapers were more the working-class papers. William Randolph Hearst, he could be very sensationalist, of course, with his news, but he also appealed to that demographic. Mm-hmm. And those are papers like the Los Angeles Herald, the Los Angeles Express, the Examiner. And so, yeah, there were different newspapers that were feeding into different readerships. And the LA Times, Harry Chandler prided himself on their giant roster of advertisers. It had a bigger advertising section than any other city in the nation. And these were largely businesses that were anti-union that took out ads, and they wanted to appease their advertisers. They wanted them to keep, you know, buying space in the LA Times. So it was almost like a reverse engineered paper, mm-hmm. that anything you read was really feeding the beast of capitalism, unbridled capitalism. Mm-hmm. And that's how it was for decades. It certainly was not, and really the nail in the coffin for them trying to be even remotely progressive during the era of which I write about was the bombing of the Times building in 1910 by two union brother activists, which ended up killing about 24 people. And so the Times remained an anti-union newsroom until, I think, 2019.
Another thing that you brought up that I didn't know about was Chandler had a limit to how many times he could be written about in the paper.
Yeah. Unlike Sherman, who was not shy about plastering his name everywhere, and some of the others, Chandler very much wanted to be behind the scenes. He wanted to be like, you know, like the wizard in the Wizard of Oz, pulling the strings. He was a puppet master in the truest sense. Mm-hmm. He was very good and influential at getting things done and growing the city. And many of the institutions we know and even love today, you can trace back to Harry Chandler, whether it was the Hollywood Bowl or Olvera Street or even the aerospace industry and all these jobs that were created here, the car manufacturers, Ford, GM, that was all Chandler's doing. But Harry wanted to be behind the scenes and building consensus and strong-arming investors into investing into the Douglas Aircraft Company, because he wanted to corner the market on building airplanes and have LA be an aerospace hub versus San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So he would meet with people in these cigar-filled, smoke-filled rooms at the California Club or the Jonathan Club, and they would give him money to pay for these enterprises. So that was his role. He was considered the governor of Southern California, even though he hated politics. He was also voted by the LA Realty Board as the most influential person in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And he even brought the Olympics here in 1932. That was his doing.
All of these things are fantastic.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I mean, and we could add to that list. I learned recently the Hollywood Palladium was funded by him too, which was like several million dollars of today's money to make that place. The Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, which I heard was built because the idea that LA had no culture really bothered a lot of these people. And so they were like, fine, let's build an opera. Let's build a classical theater. Let's build the Hollywood Bowl, things like that. And I think the Palladium fit right in with Frank Sinatra opening the place. And the culture obviously is going to be different than East Coast culture, which is good.
Yeah.
Would you say that he actually did care about culture in LA?
He definitely did. His granddaughter, Dorothy Chandler, who was married to his son, Norman Chandler, she definitely got the Music Center going. Harry Chandler put money behind growing Los Angeles culturally to compete with these other cities, because he really did feel that providing culture for the populace would raise the profile of the populace and make this a place for people to want to come and work in creative fields or even engineering and education. He was the main driver behind making Caltech what it is. It already existed in very kind of raw form, and then he really institutionalized it and was a big backer of higher education. USC and Occidental kind of had his imprints helping get them established here. They're among the older universities in LA. Mm-hmm. The Mission Playhouse in San Gabriel, that's Harry Chandler's doing. Now, some of this is romanticizing the past, of course. Right. Alvera Street is kind of a sanitized version of a Mexican marketplace and things like that. But he did feel that... the cultural business was good economic business.
But again, this is why I love your book so much, is you don't paint these men as good or bad. These are complicated people. They're human beings.
Correct.
And even if you're filthy rich like Chandler was, and maybe not playing fair with the Owens Valley people or many
and,
people.
And buying up half the valley before it annexed with LA, so he made a lot of money that way, he and Sherman.
So there's very not so good parts about these men and then beautiful parts about them. I mean, the Boeing, that takes foresight.
Yeah.
You know, and it actually worked.
Yeah.
So much of the middle class of the beach cities are because of that.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Establish a foothold for building aerospace, tires, cars, all these industries that carried LA through much of the 20th century. And so, yeah, you have to give credit to people like Harry Chandler. They were big thinkers at a time when there was not much regulation, and you could actually just get stuff done because power coalesced around this oligarchy that could grease the wheels very quickly, you know, through City Hall and all the decision makers.
That's an excellent point, the regulation, but also precedent. Mm-hmm. What other city did this in such a short period of time? Without any of the help of what East Coast people had.
Right. I think LA's wild frontier roots, which were not that far removed from when all these people started their careers in the 1890s in Los Angeles, that really helped because there was already a mentality of, you know, anything goes. And I think that was brought to bear also by San Francisco and California in general, the gold rush. Mm-hmm. It was a place where you would go, you know, they'd say, go west, young man. You know, that was a true cliche at the time where you could reinvent yourself and live in an area that was free from, you know, slavery for the most part, you know, mm-hmm. during the Civil War and after the Civil War. A very unregulated area, which was, again, good and bad. It led to real estate bubbles. It shunned tourists. It shunned unions, mm-hmm. so you could have more exponential growth because there weren't unions that were taking up some of the cost to build these things, so you can get things done more quickly and efficiently. Mm-hmm. And then it did also provide a space for, you know, that started turning in the 20s, which I also mentioned in the book, of course, that as they became these protectors of paradise, they would, Chandler in particular and the LA Times, would kind of decide who can live here and who couldn't. And that's when things kind of turned dark. You had this great expansion, but that meant everybody was coming here, including people of color, you know, certain minorities that they didn't want living here, or at least acquiring wealth here. And the population became more diluted, kind of like how it was when it started, when there were a lot of, you know, Native Americans and Mexican people living here, and then it got kind of waspy for like several decades, and then it became more cosmopolitan, and that's when the LA Times started, you know, you started seeing more restrictive covenants, and society in general in the United States started getting really just restrictive at that point in time, and the LA kind of led the charge.
The gold rush in San Francisco, and this made me think about it reading your book, is how come San Francisco didn't grow like this, and how come the successful people of San Francisco didn't come down here and imprint themselves the way that these six men did. Is it Was it the water? What is it that was different about San Francisco that they didn't grow as big and as fast as LA did? Around kind of the same time. Obviously, San Francisco had a 50-year head start.
Yeah.
But I feel like LA eclipsed them so fast.
Yeah. Well, there's that old phrase, geography as destiny. Geography is destiny. And if you look at San Francisco, it's a very hemmed-in city. It's only about 46 square miles. And that's about all it could achieve because of all the hills, because of the bay and the water. It's really on this peninsula, kind of. So it was kind of really, its growth was minimized by the fact that it exists where it exists. The weather also is not conducive to produce the way LA was when we were selling produce around the nation and around the world. So you also had extra, you know, lots of land where you could build your dream home and reinvent yourself. Harder to do in San Francisco because there was less land. It's when you go there now, it's a very dense city, you know, with houses smashed up against one another. It's very hilly, which doesn't promote itself to automobile use. It's really more about cable cars and transit, other forms of transit there. And in Los Angeles, you cannot underestimate the value of the automobile here in expanding the city. Los Angeles had more cars than any place on earth by 1920. And so that certainly made it easier to expand into the valley, eastward, the South Bay, the West Side. So all of that factored into the growth of LA, which eventually grew to almost 500 square miles.
Let's talk about banning now, because the port is something I think that we take for granted. And if this were a video game like Civilization or something like that, where you have to try to build, you even called it a megalopolis.
Like
before
the
movie came out, you called it that.
I would ask for royalties, but the movie's bombing. So
Have you seen it?
No, but I'm going to see it like Friday this later on.
Take some shrooms.
Okay. Duly noted.
It just goes places that you're like...
Then you can enjoy the ride.
Perhaps.
Some movies, like Tarantino, you know, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, kind of just a very languid movie, takes its time. That, to me, is another category. That's a hangout movie.
Right.
You just go and hang out.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I get you.
I mean, you got to see it. I mean, the man spent a lot of money on it. This is his baby. And
of course.
So, of course, I went. Okay, so the port is something that I think we take for granted, and the dynamic between Santa Monica and Long Beach and San Pedro is, you write it so beautifully, and it makes you think what would have happened if Santa Monica either naturally or if they figured out a way how to dredge it so that could have been a port, just how different LA would have been. But this is where I get into my Christianity, which maybe is just a lazy way of thinking. We're better off that the port wasn't in Santa Monica. Don't you agree?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, because even going back hundreds of years, explorers like Cabrillo and you know, some of these expansion explorers coming up the coast, they would steer their ships into what is now the port of Los Angeles. You know, for years it was San Pedro Harbor, Los Angeles Harbor. That was the most natural spot in which to moor your freighters or ships or what have you, because it is deeper water, and it was definitely dredged and made deeper by the federal government. So even the government identified that area near Pedro and Long Beach as the future home of an international seaport, because mm-hmm. it was just more conducive to it.
Right.
So Santa Monica only came into the picture in the 1890s because Southern Pacific, the train conglomerate, they wanted their own port where they could have a monopoly over the port, and they chose Santa Monica, which was a stupid idea because there's Santa Monica Bay, but it's a kind of shallow bay. Mm-hmm. And so in order to reach the ships that were loading or unloading, they built a one-mile pier known as the Long Wharf out into the bay. And the pier was like falling apart from the moment they built it. And trains would glide over the pier, you know, to meet the ships. And you would unload your cargo onto the Union or Southern Pacific train. And then it would, you know, drive the mile back to the coast. And even that tunnel, the McClure Tunnel, that the 10, when you take the 10 and you're going to Santa Monica.
Yeah.
That was a train tunnel that belonged to Southern Pacific.
Was it really?
And that linked up with the Long Wharf, which was where Sunset meets Pacific Coast Highway, where Gladstone's for Fish is. That was where the Long Wharf was. And so it would, the tracks would go along up until where PCH is, and those were all train tracks. You could see old pictures of it online. There's even, if you go to YouTube, there's early film footage in the 1890s of Thomas Edison on a train going through McClure Tunnel.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that wasn't really, that wasn't sustainable to have an international port there. Right. And so by really 1910, that whole pier was dilapidated. They sold it off. And then Long Beach and Los Angeles ports became the seaports of LA.
I feel like, though, that I don't want to say Long Beach should have gone to war with Los Angeles, but there should have been more fighting, or at least a little bloodshed. Like, they're stealing their business right next door to them, right?
Well, except that you could argue that Los Angeles was first, and that's a credit to Banning. So Banning had established then San Pedro Harbor as a port for the Union Army during the Civil War.
Oh.
And Wilmington, which is next to San Pedro, that housed barracks for soldiers. And so that's how he got the nickname General Banning. It was honorific, but it was earned in that regard because he was a true patriot.
Right.
And so he worked with the federal government to kind of early on dredge some of the government gave him money, and then he died in the 1880s, and they were still dredging it. But he got it going to make that as the harbor because the federal government decided strategically that was the best place for a harbor. So Long Beach came later.
I never knew. Yeah. So why didn't we fight Long Beach?
I was room enough for two there cities was. To have business,
plenty,
I guess.
Plenty of room.
Yeah, plenty to go around.
Plenty of room.
Yeah.
And now I think Long Beach has like a $1 billion city budget. Like, they're doing pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, Long Beach is, someone should write a real definitive history of Long Beach because it's the second biggest city in LA County. And I feel like it kind of is underrated or underwritten about.
Completely.
Yeah.
Completely. And you can still find a reasonably priced house down there.
Yep.
There's so many good things about Long Beach.
Yeah, it has its own great history.
And City of Long Beach, if you do want to sponsor a couple episodes, we'll do it for the right price.
Well, you read my previous book, Freewaytopia, right? How freeways shape Los Angeles. There was a big war between Long Beach and San Pedro as to who was going to get the tail, which city was going to be the terminus for the 710 freeway.
Uh-huh.
The Long Beach Freeway. So they got right. it, but there was a big tug of war going on then. The war of which you speak, that happened when freeways were built.
Right. Although I hardly use that one. I use the Harbor Freeway.
A lot of trucks use it. That's because you're not a trucker.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah, it's 25% of its volume at any given time.
So Paul, this is why I love this book so much, is you help us understand things that we take for granted. You help us understand how things got built, but you also teach us all the things that cities need. And LA is kind of like the Frankenstein that grew too big.
Yeah.
But it should have been destroyed if it was too big. I mean, it is too big.
It's
right?
too big to manage. I agree.
It's too big,
yeah.
And yet we're thriving.
Mm-hmm.
How?
I think it's the will of the people. We have such an amazing, diverse population base mm-hmm. that the few times that we've tried to unannex certain areas or break free, you know, and reduce the city, it hasn't worked.
Yeah.
I don't know if you were here then, but in the early 2000s, Hollywood and the San Fernando Valley tried to secede from Los Angeles. The Valley itself, had it formed its own city, that would have cut LA's square mileage in half. It would have been, you know, 250 square miles instead of 500. So that's a big chunk that you're losing.
Yeah.
And Hollywood, of course, was its own city for 7 years in the early 1900s. And so there was a movement there to break free from LA. And in both cases, it was put to a general vote. The electorate decided no. I came across some quotes from that era when I was researching Inventing Paradise, and people said, you know what? You're cutting out the soul of LA if you lose Hollywood or mm-hmm. the Valley. And, you know, so sometimes it's like the devil you know is sometimes the better part of the equation.
But isn't that like overly dramatic? Like, we still have Beverly Hills. We still have Santa Monica. We still have yeah. all these other cities. I mean, I love Pasadena, mm-hmm. but I don't think that LA is negatively impacted because Pasadena is its own city. Do you?
Not at all. I think Pasadena is enriched by being its own city.
Yeah.
I think Hollywood maybe could have, you know, Hollywood's, as long as I've lived here, it's always been a little shaggy, shall
right,
we say,
right.
At least from the 70s onward, even in the 60s. And so I feel maybe it could benefit from being autonomous, and it would keep some of those same resources for its own maintenance and mm-hmm. city services and amenities for the unhoused. Mm-hmm. I've worked in Burbank many times, and I have friends who live there. And I'll tell you, it's pretty ideal compared to LA when you talk about police response,
yep.
cleanliness, schools, although the boroughs is very overcrowded from what I'm understanding. Mm-hmm. But it has that same small town vibe that I remember growing up as mm-hmm. someone who spent a lot of time in the Valley. And I think it's for the better that Burbank's its own city. You also have your own identity as a city. That
That's
gets
right.
lost when you join Los Angeles. And many communities at the time when they annexed with LA bemoaned the fact that they were no longer a place that people could associate with its own identity.
That's right. I mean, look at Inglewood. Inglewood would not have gotten that football stadium
yeah.
if they were LA. In fact, that's why they did get the football stadium. They wanted to be in LA, these football teams, but LA couldn't get it together.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to either pay off or I should probably say work with one mayor instead of all these councilmen and all these other people. And suddenly Inglewood is the star of LA County right now.
Correct.
And is going to be it during the Olympics for sure, right?
Yeah, I think it's going to play a big part of the Olympics. I think what you see in Los Angeles is people reclaiming communities that, you know, in the last 10, 20 years is when you've seen signs like Valley Village popping up and places that, you know, when I was a kid, it was just known as North Hollywood. But
yeah.
even North Hollywood's not North Hollywood anymore. It's NoHo.
Right.
It's the NoHo Arts District. And I think that's good because you want pride in the neighborhood that you live in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think LA has stayed together, because people understand that I could just be in my little hood. You know, for me, it's like Los Feliz, Franklin Hills.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like home. I don't have to leave my neighborhood on weekends sometimes. Everything I need
yeah.
is right here. And so that's, I think, the key to surviving LA is finding your niche. And the fact that the city is trying to become less car dependent.
Mm.
Then, you know, you can live near where you work, near where you take the train.
Mm-hmm.
It is a more dense city. It's going in that direction.
The Valley being its own city.
Mm-hmm.
If it was its own city, would it jack up the water rates on us? Is that the reason that LA wants to keep...
I think that's a non-factor now, because mm-hmm. Los Angeles would just renegotiate a rate with the Metropolitan Water District that would be commiserate with its populace. Maybe
so why not? Because here's why I'm in favor of the Valley being its own city. It's as big as San Diego,
mm-hmm.
and it hardly ever gets talked about. And this podcast was based on that idea that we live next door to San Diego and we ignore it every frickin' day. Meanwhile, South LA is also being ignored by everybody, from the city to you name it.
Right.
And I feel like if the Valley was its own thing, maybe LA would pay more attention to South LA.
That's what you would hope. I agree with you that I could envision a day when the Valley is its own city, because it's... on its own, it would make the sixth largest city by area in the United States.
Crazy, right?
Crazy. And so imagine how you could manage your own resources if you were your own city. And then what that does to alleviate LA from, I mean, I was in a deep, far-flung part of the Valley last week. I think I was in Chatsworth or Canoga Park. I remember like driving around like, God damn, I'm still in LA. And it was like kind of a really scruffy area. I'm like, you know what? There's no love out here in the Northwest corner.
No.
Let me tell you, as with South LA and other far-flung areas, and even in, you know, more central LA, let's face it, there's problems everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I do often wonder that. And it's something that occasionally I will come up in conversation. I do take the stance that LA should look into divesting of some of itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, especially for the school district point of view. Because the things that are happening in Chatsworth, God bless them, are nothing like what's happening in Baldwin Hills.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's stop pretending that one school district can take care of all these people, because they clearly can't.
Right.
And so let's help. I mean, but I guess you got to pay attention to the families that can't afford private schools.
That's what started the conversation in my head, at least, and with other people, was the school district. Because my kids did go to Los Angeles Unified Schools. Mm-hmm. And I could see firsthand, especially during COVID, how the school district was just stretched thin.
Yep.
And it was an ongoing problem, even when we weren't in COVID, trying to deliver all the resources to all the students. Mm-hmm. And then multiply that by all the different departments, the police department, mm-hmm. fire, you know, first responders, medical, education, everything, every aspect that makes a city grow and thrive and mm-hmm. and function has been diluted.
Right.
And, you know, maybe if we have smart leaders and we streamline things, and I know we're trying to improve the business environment for entrepreneurs so there's mm-hmm. less red tape. Mm-hmm. I know there's been progress made on that. But really what you need are these visionaries like who I write about in my book,
yep.
who are just going to take charge and decide this is what our city is going to be. But we live in a time of a lot of bureaucracy and red tape, and I don't mm-hmm. even know if I argue at the end of my book, these people would, you wouldn't even know them today. They'd be kind of lumped in with everybody else
yeah.
because they, what they could accomplish would be minimized by the current political environment.
A guy who I think would have made your book if he was 100 years older is Rick Caruso, who would be the mayor of the Valley if the Valley was its own city, right?
Yeah. I think Caruso, someone, had he been born 100 years ago, probably he would have been the seventh character in my book, probably.
Right, right. Absolutely. Because he's this visionary.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's aggressive. He seems to get things done.
He was Republican, like these guys mostly
Republican.
Were.
Republican. I mean, you talk about Burbank and Glendale. I'm at Americana at the Brand all the time. All the time. I saw Megabocalypse there in IMAX.
Yeah.
It's. I don't like him, but he makes cool stuff.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you could argue those are the Grove, Americana, even Universal City Walk, which is not, you know, Caruso's stamp.
Too?
No, that's not him. But right. that such places, they're kind
artificial.
Of...
artificial.
Yeah, there's antiseptic, they're curated, yeah. you know, they're Disney-fied, you know, but they're popular and,
yep.
and people are going to them because for the same reason you go to Disneyland or places like that, it feels like a sheltered place from the world
yep.
where you can kind of escape for a little bit, but also conduct business, see a movie, go to a bookstore, get mm-hmm. a nice meal, and people want more of that.
Yeah.
And I think in you can create real world versions of that in cities that, as I was alluding to earlier, if there's a lot of community pride, you can create that feeling of like, oh, I feel safe here. I feel mm-hmm. amongst my own. And mm-hmm. I'm hoping we see more of that because, you know, it's not good to have walled off, fortressed, kind of siloed areas where you can't see it from the street. You
right.
do want places where people can walk to and it opens up into the street. And that's what,
yes.
You know, that was the old problem with LACMA, for example, that it looked like, you know, giant wall walking into it. So anyway, I think that we're moving toward that, and there's hopefully a happy medium in between a kind of more sterile place and real world that are both welcoming.
Also, how great would it be for Caruso and his ego if he could make his own police force out there? Because you know he loves the cops. But it's separate from the LAPD, and he's competing with LA now. He can say the Valley is better than LA because of all these things now. I think competition is great, which is why I loved how many newspaper sources you used on here. Because when Chandler was involved in some dirty stuff, it wasn't in the LA Times, but these other places had it. And got, by the way, how did you get into the archives of these other newspapers? I can understand how you got the LA Times, but these dead papers, how'd you get those?
Well, before the internet, we'd pull microfiche, and what has replaced that are sites like newspapers.com, where you can just be in your pajamas drinking a beer on your laptop, and you can pull up that same information you used to get from the library just through these different portals. And so when you go to newspapers.com, which is what I subscribe to, you can pull up most of the old LA papers, not all of them, but the databases that have been integrated into their library.
I didn't know those old ones were in there.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and as well as other cities around, you know, the world.
Your research is amazing on this, so bravo to you.
Thank
on
you.
That. How long did it take you to write this book?
The research part took about a year.
That's all?
Yeah. And including some interviews with some people, but doing the heavy lifting of going to the Huntington Library or the Sherman Library, which is a great library in Corona Del Mar.
Oh, down there?
Yeah, because he settled there at the end of his life. And so everything has been archived, all of his papers and ephemera is down there. This beautiful library and gardens right there, like... near in Newport Beach. Those were two areas I went to. CSUN's library for a lot of the Mulholland stuff because his granddaughter, Catherine Mulholland, has a great collection there. Nice. Those were like the big three, augmented by interviews with some experts, maybe 15, 20 people I talked to, and then the bulk of it being books and newspapers. So that process, as I was researching, the spine of the book was coming together. To a point where after a year, I felt like I knew where I was going with this. I knew I wanted to intercut between the six protagonists to make it seem like a movie.
You did.
You know, like you kind of leave one chapter with a little cliffhanger on Moses Sherman. Now we're back to Mulholland, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So then that process took about a year to do a rough draft to deliver my publisher.
Unbelievable that you were able to do it in just a year.
Yeah, I was. A lot of it was I knew where to go to look for research because I have written about LA and I've read a lot of LA books. So that kind of fast tracked a lot of my research.
I see.
I knew the parts I needed to delve into more. The other ones, I could almost put placeholders as I was writing, knowing I could access that more familiar research. I could source that pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So I had a head start. You can. You know, someone who just dropped into LA and didn't know anything about it.
Yeah.
Sure, the research would take a couple of years, probably.
Sorry, New York Times. You're not going to be able to beat Paul on this one. Obviously, we've seen his name everywhere. But I didn't know how much more we could have seen his name. Mm-hmm. He was a guy that loved putting his name on stuff. But he also was a guy that loved to share. So his giant mansion is something that we can visit now, right?
Absolutely. I was just there yesterday.
Were you?
Yeah.
Why were you there yesterday?
I'm toying with a new book, and I was doing some preliminary research. Mm. This is not necessarily a bulletin. I'm still like in the gathering information stage,
mm-hmm.
but I had to renew my membership as a researcher there. So you actually get access that the general public doesn't for their library, and mine had expired. So this is my first day back there in like months since this Inventing Paradise came out.
Yeah.
So, but then I also walked the grounds and because it's very inspirational. But yes, Henry Huntington, he had the soul of an artist. He was very sensitive. He liked nature. He liked works of art. And everything he did in his career, yes, he was also a rapacious entrepreneur, but he also loved the arts. And everything was kind of a means to an end.
Mm-hmm.
So when he accumulated his wealth, he wanted to share it with the public and create these beautiful grounds, the Huntington Gardens and the Huntington Library to attract scholars. That also, that boosted his cred also.
Mm-hmm.
And there's power in owning an institution that has gardens, a museum, art gallery, a library. And that's where he focused his energies out in San Marino for really the last 20 years of his life.
My note for him is that he helped us with the roads. How did he help LA with roads?
Well, so he first laid what he indirectly helped with roads. He helped lay down the grid, the foundation for a lot of arterials that we take for granted today. So he ran his Red Line, which was a streetcar line through Cahuenga Pass before there was a Hollywood freeway, as one example. And so a lot of his rail lines, you know, going to the harbor, we eventually built the 110 freeway over where his lines used to go down to San Pedro. So he helped lay down rail up to 1,000 miles worth of streetcars in the early 1900s that eventually became major highways or freeways. And but as far as like him building roads, he would build them like Huntington Boulevard and other streets, but that was usually a way to connect people with his suburbs, his little communities that he built, where he also had a monopoly on electricity and gas and other utilities. So he made a killing in terms of very sectors.
We know that Sherman also had his trains. Did they did they work together? Were they rivals as far as rail, or was there enough for both of them that they could be cool with each other?
They both early on in like 1893, they both owned the Pasadena-Altadena Railway. And they, you know, they had a decent partnership and they became friendly. They were frenemies for most of their lives.
Oh, were they? Okay.
Yeah. So when Sherman kind of over leveraged himself and started building too much rail or acquiring local rail companies, and then they went belly up and he was stuck holding the debt, Huntington would often bail him out because Huntington at that point had already inherited millions of dollars. Mm. So they were friendly in that regard. And in fact, when Huntington was in the hospital, Sherman wrote him some nice notes, vice versa. You know, they looked after each other. But then there was a point when Huntington felt betrayed because earlier in our conversation, I mentioned the balloon route. Right. That was the big route going to the west side that was owned by Moses Sherman. He started selling it off in 1906. He just wanted to unload himself from it and focus on real estate. And Huntington thought he'd made a deal with Sherman to acquire the balloon route, and that would allow Huntington access all the way to the beach for his rail. And at the last minute, Sherman decided to sell it to Southern Pacific. Right. And boy, that set Huntington off in a tizzy at that point. Huntington used to work for Southern Pacific. His uncle owned it, but... By that point in time, Huntington had nothing to do with Southern Pacific. So it was a double betrayal because now Sherman was selling it to the company that cut him loose.
Why do you think he did that?
You know, I think he just saw a better deal. I don't think he meant to hurt Huntington. Yeah. And Sherman, even though he was a gentleman, all these guys could be very cutthroat. Mm. And if it meant turning on a former partner, they would do it.
Wow.
And I felt like his biggest friend, Moses Sherman, was Harry Chandler. He never crossed him, never betrayed him. Mm-hmm. Huntington was dispensable at that point for him.
Obviously, there's going to be Avengers movies about all these Avengers, but Mulholland, I think, would be the first one because he was such a genius. I would say more so than all these other people because, I mean, his first claim to fame, the first thing that you show us is him, like, fixing...
The LA River.
The LA River. Like almost like he's sticking his arm into the darkness of the LA River and pulling out what was clogged.
Yes.
Something like superhero like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Around 1890, LA's population at that point was probably, I want to say 20, 30,000 people. And Los Angeles relied on the Los Angeles River. And this is well before the aqueduct, of course. And Mulholland was the water chief. And he loved nothing more than to be the savior. And he leaned into that to the point where when there was a problem with water being delivered to homes around Christmas of that year, he decided, all right, let's see what's going on here. And he himself went sloshing through the LA River and never dressed, never, how did the LA Times put it? He was never dressed like a Christian for 4 days.
so he's
rooting around in his underwear and bare feet, I think, trying to figure out what the problem was. Did not sleep. He admitted he did not sleep for 4 days, and he found the clog in a conduit that opened up the water and allowed water to flow on Christmas Eve, and he became the man who saved Christmas. And so he was deified after that. He could do no wrong.
Right.
And that went to his head because he created and designed everything himself, whether it was reservoirs that we still use today, mm-hmm. like Franklin Canyon, Silver Lake, Encino Reservoir, Lake Hollywood. He created the dams for the beautiful dam at Lake Hollywood as well, which is called Mulholland Dam. He was honored 3 different days in LA's history. I mean, who gets one whole day in their honor? He had 3. One of them was for opening Mulholland Drive in 1924. Another was the opening of the LA Aqueduct in 1913, the opening of Lake Hollywood in 1925. And so when you, you know, are built up, you start believing the bullshit. He just could figure he could do no wrong, and people gave him carte blanche to do whatever he wanted mm-hmm. because he was helping the city. And that was, unfortunately, his tragic downfall.
Which I never knew about this terrible accident the, that happened.
He was a completely self-educated man. Mm-hmm. He was an autodidact. He was self-made, learned engineering and hydrology on his own. Mm-hmm. Maybe he should have gotten some, today you would call it like peer reviews, right?
Right. That he didn't have like a brainiac assistant. He didn't have anybody around him.
He had
him.
People under him, but he called the shots.
Right.
And so there weren't committees that would check his work, as it were. So when he mm-hmm. built this dam called the St. Francis Dam in 1926, it opened. It was a dam about 20 miles north of LA, kind of just near today's Castaic. Okay. And it held back.
So way up there.
Way up there, yeah.
Okay.
In fact, in Chinatown, they allude to a broken dam, a dam that broke in the middle of the night, and that was inspired by St. Francis Dam.
I feel like you could make a better Chinatown.
Well, you could do the actual story of the St. Francis Dam, because it lasted only 2 years. It held back 8 billion gallons of water. There was kind of a fatal flaw in not so much the design, although that factored in as well, but in where he built it. He built it so that the edges, the buttresses of the dam are up against an ancient landslide made of slate. Like slate's not a good rock to connect a dam to, but he built it without any geologists, reviewing the site where he built it. And 2 years into it, it had been leaking for a while also. So it was already compromised. It was leaking from the base. And he ignored all of these warning signs to his peril. And so it burst in the middle of the night in 1928. And, you had just an ocean of water rushing downstream all the way to today's Ventura. So it went down what was known, it's still known as the Santa Clara Valley. That's where you see Piru and Fillmore and all these little farming towns. Mm-hmm. And it wiped out all these communities and killed about 500 people.
They said that, or at least you said, that the dam looked like it was crying to some people before it burst.
It looked like it was crying. Yeah, it had water dribbling down the face of the dam, of its edifice. And
so people knew this isn't what a dam is supposed to look like.
Right. Dams often will leak. They have little leaks here and there. But some of these were more leaks than normal. And there was leakage at the bottom of the dam, which meant the foundation was compromised and it was muddy.
Right.
In fact, he looked at the muddy water 12 hours before the dam burst, and he signed off on it. He's like, it's just dirty water because it's just getting in contact with the ground. It's just water, and he signed off on it and drove back to LA for lunch.
Which you wrote perfectly. Mm-hmm. I thought that it was a different guy who looked at that water and saw
it. It was Mulholland and his crony, Van Norman.
Van Norman.
I believe
it was
Van Norman.
Okay.
Yeah, who's with him.
So Van Norman was just a yes man.
Pretty much.
Which you can't be when you're talking about
that. Yeah, but that's how it was then. He was the man. He mm-hmm. was God. So it was hard to say no to him.
How about before lunch? Be like, bro, I don't know, man. Like, I'm not going to say this to the press.
Well, he could have said, this is really alarming. I recommend we evacuate everybody downriver. And they could have gotten most people out of there because they had 10 hours for the dam burst. So you go up and down like Paul Revere and with mm-hmm. sirens on. Everyone needs to evacuate. That could have saved a lot of lives mm-hmm. while they check it out and really see what's going on. Unfortunately, I don't think they would have caught the fact that it was the wings of the dam that were compromised. Also, that's where it burst at first. It was the water under the dam was a contributing factor, mm-hmm. but I don't know if they ever really would have gotten to the source of it. It was only decades later that geologists and experts realized what the actual problem was.
You grew up here. You went to great schools. Mm-hmm. Was this taught in school? Because I've never heard of this.
Never. I didn't know about it till the 90s when I was in my 30s. Mm-hmm. And not only, I'd read Water from the Angels. Catherine Mulholland, his granddaughter, has written some great books.
Really?
I highly recommend them about her grandfather. Heavily sourced for my book. And this was, pre-GPS.
Right.
And I was hell-bent on trying to figure out where the hell this thing was built.
So you didn't even know where it was?
I didn't even know. Not only did I not know about it, but I didn't know where it was. The book gave some hints. It said it was off San Francisquito Road in the Santa Clara Valley, which is just northeast of Castaic. And mm-hmm. I was familiar with Santa Clarita, mm-hmm. so I knew it was just beyond that a little bit. And so what I did was I drove out with my car and I drove on San Francisco Canyon Road because I knew the dam was just a few more miles up, like in that valley. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, if I were a dam, where would I be? And I would be at the most narrow point of the valley, right? Because that's where you would hold back the water.
Yeah.
So I pulled over at what I thought was potentially where he built it. And I climbed this hillside and I found the remnants of the St. Francis Dam. Actually went up there and found old bits of concrete 7 years later, which were still lying on the ground. And it was like really eye-opening.
So this picture in the middle of your book, you've got all these pictures, which are great to see. There is a picture of the dam. Is this your picture or did you get this from somewhere else?
That is a public domain photo. There's a lot of pictures of the dam after it broke. And so you mentioned the dam looked like it was crying before it broke.
Yeah.
After the dam burst, they mentioned it left only the middle portion of it, which looked like a giant tombstone, which was emblematic of the people who died not only in the valley, but the end of Mulholland's career.
Were you able to see the tombstone when you were there, or is it gone now?
That was taken down, I think, in the 30s, like a few years after it burst. Mm. But they just left a lot of the concrete there.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if it's still there at this day and age, but this was in the 90s. It was just, a lot of it was still left there. I was shocked. I was the only person there wandering around checking that out. And they're going to put a memorial, if they haven't already, they're going to try to actually call more attention to the tragedy and more people will know about it by putting a nice memorial out there.
So do you think this isn't part of LA history in schools and in popular culture because it's so far away? I mean, 20 miles away is
it's outside far. LA city limits. It doesn't get as much play.
And the people who died were in Fillmore and Ventura, and who cares about them?
A lot of migrant workers, many of them probably not here legally.
Yeah.
Didn't get the same attention as, say, if there was a giant earthquake that took out 500 people, you know, in 19 whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. So, that I think that factors in, but also the fact it wasn't, it is a little outside the city.
Mm-hmm.
And,
in LA, we don't like losers.
We don't like losers. But you're right, though. It's the biggest man-made disaster in the history of California.
Which I never knew. I never knew. Because, and again, they don't teach this. Mm-hmm. They don't reference it compared to other disasters.
Yeah.
But it still killed his reputation.
Yeah.
Even though, how old was he at the time? Like 70?
He was well into his 70s.
Yeah.
He'd been working for 50 plus years. He was reaching his natural completion, I think, as an employee. He'd far surpassed the retirement age.
Right.
But no one could say no to him. He wanted to keep working. That led to his self-worth. Mm-hmm. And he was a broken man after that. He suffered several strokes. My favorite picture in that book, it's the saddest picture, is I think it's one of the last ones, where he's standing with Moses Sherman and Harry Chandler, and they're standing on Moses Sherman's boat in 1932.
I like this picture too.
It's a candid taken by some amateur photographer. You could see his head, the silhouette of his head in the bottom of the frame. And Mulholland used to be this really stately oak tree of a guy.
Uh-huh.
And he's just a wispy figure at that point with like a droopy eye. You could tell that he's aged about 20 years in just 5 years.
Right.
And it was really sad.
And what's interesting about this photo is it doesn't look like any of them really want to take this picture.
Yeah.
They're the godfathers of LA.
Yeah. I don't know who took it, but that I stumbled on that as one of the last visits I made to Huntington Library as part of my research. And once I had that, I was almost shouting with joy in the library, like, oh my God. Because it was this core group, these three guys who were these old, dowdy old codgers at that point. Chandler, Sherman, and Mulholland. Chandler is still the most vibrant then, and in the picture he looks very impatient, like, take the picture, please, let's go.
I got millions to
I got things to do, yeah. And he lived another 10 years after
What was the name of the boat that they posed on?
The SS Sherman.
Of course.
Yeah, of course.
You have to have your name on it.
He couldn't even name after his wife, you know? It had to be the SS Sherman.
Let's wrap up with Franklin Hills. You're in a storybook house.
Literal storybook house.
How many storybook houses are there in Franklin Hills, let's say?
In Franklin Hills, there are about 10 or 12.
Okay.
And but three or four of them are part of this whole complex that is behind these gates. You can't even see them from the street.
Which gates?
Off of Mayview. It's a private driveway that leads to a series of storybook houses that were built by one person. The rest of them are accessible from, you know, from streets.
What neighborhood is that?
Franklin Hills, but it's off of Mayview, the street.
There's a gated community in Franklin Hills?
It's not a gated community. If I said that, I misspoke. It's a gated driveway that leads to a multi-acre site that has a couple little storybook cottages on it from a millionaire who built it like 100 years ago.
Have you been behind these gates?
No, you need to go through an architectural tour, and it changed ownership like 4 years ago. It's pretty private.
But it's not impossible, it sounds like.
Probably not.
Or if I'm the Domino's guy, I could get through there, right?
I'm sure where there's a will, there's a way. So I'm sure if you're really dedicated to getting in there, you could find that.
Who wouldn't want to see this place that's not seen? Well, okay.
There are amazing pictures of it. I know that.
Well, this is why. So, Paul, you invited me over for your Oscar party at the beginning of this year. Thank you for having me here. And I'd never been in a storybook house before. And so from the road, you can kind of see that it looks like Sleeping Beauty's art from Disney.
Yeah, like a Hansel and Gretel house. For the uninitiated, it's the same architecture you see at the Witch's House in Beverly Hills, the Tam O'Shanter restaurant, the little Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs houses behind Gelson's on Hyperion in Silver Lake. So our house kind of has so many of the same features, really pitched roofs and kind of like quirky, you know, just whimsy, a sense of whimsy to it.
And the reason that we can imagine those houses when you say it, it's because Disney actually lived around here and had his artists draw based on the houses that were already here.
Yeah, the Snow White houses, which also make an appearance in Mulholland Drive, the David Lynch movie. But those were built first. And he brought his animators to those little cottages, which were built in like 1932, and Snow White came out in 1937. So he had his animators sit down and sketch them out. And there's these great split screens you can find online of like, here's what one of the Snow White cottages looks like in real life, and here's the actual one in the movie. And it's really kind of uncanny.
Do these houses sell more than a house that has the same square footage right next door to it, or is it less?
It's, you know what, the comps to me looked very comparable. I think this particular house had been sitting on the market for months. We actually, my wife and I got it at a discount because the sellers at that point were very motivated. Mm. And we weren't looking for a storybook house. I appreciate LA history and quirky architecture, but I wasn't looking for a fairy tale type looking house.
Yeah.
But once we moved in, we realized why it was on the market for a while, because it does need a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, these aren't for everybody. It's got a single garage, which you can't even get a regular car into. You probably could get a Model T back in the day.
Really?
Yeah, so we can't really park in our garage.
Oh.
The kitchen and bathrooms are very small. So again, not for everybody. And you can talk to my wife and she can give you a litany of things she does not like about living here. But it is inspirational, and there was a Disney animator who actually lived here in the 40s.
Cool.
So I feel like I'm living amongst proper ghosts, you know, inspirational like people who lived here. And there was a great film writer, a screenwriter in the 30s who lived here, wrote some Hitchcock movies and stuff.
Wow.
So it's got good bones and good spirits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. So if you're going to invest in a house like this, be prepared. You're going to have to work on some stuff.
Yeah.
And so we're in your, do you call this your basement?
Yeah.
Okay. It's
like
below,
the third level of a three-level house. It's the bottom level.
Which is rare in LA. Unless you're on the side of a hill.
Yeah, we're built, it's on the side of a hill. So from the street, it looks like almost like a single-story house, little fairy tale house from the street. But you realize there's an incline and it kind of crawls down the hillside.
Which is awesome.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at these rafters above us. This is what it's all about.
Yeah, a lot of wood.
I mean, but it's just so homey and feel like even your
sconces.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I'm in LA.
Well, that's the other thing. If you buy a house like this, if you want to improve it or work on it, that's also expensive because to buy a sconce to put on the wall, it's got to match the original sconces of the house. And so you need antique sconces in Pasadena that start at $800 each.
No.
Yeah. Now you could do replicas, and we've done that too, stuff off of even Amazon for like a chandelier that we got in our bedroom that people think is hundreds of dollars. It was $79 off Amazon.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
I never thought of that.
Yeah, so you've got to be committed. You've got to be committed. And I actually wrote a letter to the seller to kind of help separate us from other buyers that we would be a good steward of the house, that I've written about old Los Angeles. I even talk about storybook houses in one of my previous books. Mm-hmm. I offered him a copy of the book. I thought, why not? You know, leave it all on the table.
Yeah.
And our real estate agent said, no one does letters. Don't do that. That's not done anymore. That's kind of gauche. And that's, you know, I was like, really? I'm doing it anyway.
Good for you.
Yeah. And guess what? It helped. And I know it helped because the owner's brother, who helped us with some things when we moved in, he was very sweet. He said, by the way, he loved your letter. And we think that helped you get the house because he was raving about, you know, you were going to be a good steward of the house.
How many nice things do we get in our mailbox a month? Maybe one.
Not many. Maybe a paycheck. A tax return.
And if we do, we've been waiting for that sucker for a while.
Exactly.
But like out of the blue, have a nice note saying I'm going to really
take
care of
it. Yeah, I had it passed along from his real estate agent who was very nice. And mm-hmm. so I think that helped seal the deal.
Let's talk about Franklin Hills just a little bit. The high school is probably the most famous landmark here, true?
Yeah, Marshall High. It was in, you know, that's the last scene of Grease where they had the carnival. It's been used in a lot of movies. Very iconic high school. Also a rare Gothic school, Gothic architecture in general, which was kind of, I love that they built things with a sense of whimsy then in the 20s. You know, when that was the same era that this house was built. Mm-hmm. I so prize that era, the 20s. And that overlaps with my book when a lot of these guys were living. They just, you know, they had a sense of adventure about things and, you know, not playing things safe. And let's build the Shakespeare Bridge,
right,
where Franklin is now with a bunch of turrets and these spires. And that's an iconic little bridge now.
Why did they name it after him?
No one really knows.
Oh, really?
It just looks like something out of a Shakespeare sonnet or the setting of one of his stories. And so, you know, the storybook houses, Shakespeare Bridge, Marshall High, which has this great, you know, watchtower that's Gothic, you know, looking, and even all the little hidden pedestrian staircases around here, mm-hmm. all built in the 20s.
Did any of your kids go to Marshall?
Yeah, my daughter went there.
Do you know the nickname of their basketball and football team?
They're the Barristers, aren't they? Their sports
team? The weirdest nickname I've heard
of. We're going to lawyer up on you.
Go Lawyers? What?
It sounded better, I guess, than the Public Defenders. I don't know.
I guess.
Call it the Counselors, even. I don't.
Did she enjoy herself at?
Yeah, she was like in. She had a little niche there. It was like the gifted student department, so she could enjoy the entire campus while also having smaller class sizes and get the benefits of that. It was like the best of both worlds for her.
So you do recommend it for people who are considering.
I am going to, as much as there are problems with LA Unified System, I would recommend it highly if you can, if your student thrives in that kind of environment. It's good to be amongst, I think, a non-privileged crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Having a diverse student body, I think, is really great. Having, if your kid's into sports, you know, great sports programs, that's really bonding for the student. My son played baseball at North Hollywood High, so, you know, thousands of kids there. Mm. And then I do, my wife and I believe it benefited them for college because they were able to do well in their schools, it helped that they took several AP courses that raised their GPAs. And that, of course, draws the attention of colleges that they were applying to. Mm-hmm. But not only that, they came from schools that were considered urban schools, where English was a second language for lots of households, where many of the kids, unfortunately, were living even under the poverty level or needed school lunches.
Mm.
So when your student is excelling in an environment like that, it gets more attention from the colleges versus someone who maybe, you know, went to Brentwood or Harvard Westlake, who has a 4.0. And yeah, guess what? So do 200 other students.
Right.
And how are you going to separate them out? So you do get more attention. And that is something that our college counselor, who we had for both kids, told us was beneficial.
Do they still have the Los Feliz flea market at Marshall, or has that moved?
That's moved to downtown near Dodger Stadium, actually.
Yeah.
Right off Sunset. In fact, because my son works there.
Does he?
Yeah, up until when he left for college. He would go there on weekends and work.
It had to move because it was too popular, right?
Correct. There might have been other issues with Marshall, but I think it outgrew that space.
Did you ever shop around there or browse?
My kids more than me, but I loved it. I mean, I was the times I went, yeah, it was really fun.
I loved it because these are things in our closets. They were having rock concert t-shirts of shows I went to that these kids probably don't even know half these bands. Like, name three Deep Purple songs, sir. You know? and you've got vinyl here. Like, they have records from the 80s and 90s. Like, I couldn't believe. Yeah. I mean, I guess I can. But I was always under the impression that you don't like the music when you're older because you're still rooted to the music that you grew up with. Mm-hmm. And so to see kids say, nah, today's music sucks. We're grunge people too. Is beautiful.
It's beautiful. And what's great is I'm of the theory that great music will always find its audience no matter what generation. Mm-hmm. Because my kids were finding things on their own, maybe like obscure Bowie that I had never turned them on to, or the Pixies, whatever, that... Yeah, I would listen to a lot of this stuff, but not in front of them. Some stuff I did, but I remember some artists I hadn't. And, you know, my son would say something like, Dad, you ever heard of Joe Jackson? I'm like, I love Joe Jackson. His first record's incredible, you know, Get Sharp and all that. And yeah. He's like, oh, I've already been through that one. Yeah, he's great. I tell my playlist now, I'm like, whoa, or the first Cars record he found on his own. Mm-hmm. I love the Cars in high school,
yes.
Especially that first record. So, like, music that stands the test of time, it's fun to see them find it amidst all the new music. They like us, they're able to curate and sort out, okay, this is bad, this is derivative. Okay, this Nirvana guy is onto something, this yeah. Bowie guy. You know, so like, the, you know, if you have good taste in music, you'll find the true artists.
Yes. Any hidden spots of Franklin Village?
Franklin Hills.
Franklin Hills.
Yeah, it goes back to the staircases. Franklin Hills is situated, I like to call it Los Feliz trying to be Silver Lake.
Okay.
It's in the southeast corner of Los Feliz, right above Hyperion. Right over Hyperion is Silver Lake. It has that funky vibe like Silver Lake.
Yep.
It's got quirky neighbors and quirky houses like this. It's not for everybody.
Right.
Right? There's no McMansions here. People move into these.
There aren't?
Not around here. People do not tear down homes here. You live into these homes because they were built in the 20s, like this storybook house that we're in, because they have a history and a personality. And so you get architects and artists and musicians and people like that living here.
Interesting.
Yeah, and you get lawyers and others, but you just have an appreciation for architecture. So part of the other reason people like living here is, again, the hidden gem that to me is the great appeal is all these hidden staircases between streets that were built in the 20s. They led to many of the railways that were owned by Huntington. you know, so I feel rooted to the city. I like the feeling of that connection to old Los Angeles and living amongst ghosts, like yes. I said. And this neighborhood accomplishes both for me.
So you were living in the first time that you were...
North of the Boulevard, north of Los yes. Feliz Boulevard, close to Griffith Park.
And
that's where I used to be.
And when you moved, I'm always fascinated why people move out of places and why people move into places. Why did you choose Franklin Hills?
I wanted to stay near Griffith Park because I would... That kept me alive and healthy, walking into the park every day,
yes.
getting my steps in.
Which, by the way, it sounds like a lot of these rich guys like too.
Yeah, I mean, people will drive and hike. You know, they'll drive to the park mm-hmm. and hike in the park every day, folks. But it was nice to be walking distance from those trails where I didn't have any excuses not to do it almost every day. I didn't have to get in my car.
But like Chandler could have lived anywhere.
He lived right by the park. He lived
yeah.
two blocks from my old house.
Yeah,
but what kind of sold me on Franklin Hills is there is a pocket of nature here. You know, there's coyotes and raccoons, and there's owls that roost up in our big cedar trees up above. We hear them hooting every night.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got its own little ecosystem here, which is kind of cool. So I felt, okay, I'm still amongst nature.
Yep.
And I also moved out of that area because it started getting really crowded on Greek theater nights.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
you know, especially when they introduce, sorry, not, you know, no offense taken here, hopefully, but Uber was like the death of our neighborhood, of our street, because once they introduced ride sharing, they started going up and down our street, and then they added shuttle buses, and we couldn't get out of our driveway on Greek theater nights.
Mm-hmm.
And so really the last several years, we were kind of eyeballing maybe moving somewhere else for that reason.
What was number two on your list, if not this neighborhood?
I never wanted to move out. There is no number two. Los Feliz to me is the best neighborhood for my purposes in Los Angeles. It's close to all the old iconic things in LA, the Observatory, even Dodger Stadium. I'm a big Dodger fan. The LA River, downtown. I'm close to the Valley, where I like to go to sometimes, close to Hollywood, which is historic. And it's very walkable, and it's got the park, you know, Griffith Park. So it hits on a lot of levels for me, where I don't have to leave the neighborhood some weekends. I could see a movie there. I can go into Skylight Books. Yep. It suits my purposes in a way that other neighborhoods don't. So I would have just moved to a different house in Los Feliz, I think.
Paul, you're the best.
This is great. Thank you.
I'm so glad that you liked it. Thank you for writing this book for me, because your 1 year of research would have taken me a thousand years. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tony.
And where do you recommend people pick up your book?
Their local bookstore. If you live in SoCal, most bookstores have it, but if they don't, you could order it or just go to Amazon.
And I also listen to it on audio, and you read it. And for those of us who have difficulties reading a regular book, it was nice to hear your voice on there.
I prefer audiobooks when the author reads them.
Yeah.
I like that it's not only sometimes a little unpolished, which is more human, but they're also pronouncing the names correctly.
Right.
I listened to an audiobook where Eli Broad was mentioned many times, and it was an actor, like narrator, like a voice artist, who kept saying Eli Broad and Warner Bros.
No.
He said Warner Bros, not Warner Brothers.
Oh, my
That
God.
Was actually a book on Francis Ford Coppola. That book that just came out on him this year, the narrator, every time Warner Brothers, written B-R-O-S, period.
Yeah.
He would read it as, so Warner Bros. Greenlit the movie. I'm like, what the hell? I rewound. I'm like, did he just say bros? And he utters Warner Bros. Like 20 times throughout the book. He never says brothers. Mm. We all know it's Warner Brothers. Who hasn't been seeing old Warner Brothers cartoons or movies? Right. It's never been Warner Bros.
Yeah.
No one corrected him. He got it wrong. It wasn't the author reading it. Even the producers, the editors, for God's sake, the publisher who put out this audiobook, no one caught that?
Mm-hmm.
That's why I had to read my own book.
Well, I'm glad you did, because as I was driving around LA listening to it, rewinding in all the time, especially when those monkeys started voting, I was like, what? Honestly, I rewound more on this book than any other that I've had, because there's so many facts in here that blew my mind. So thank you for taking the time of making this, and we look forward to the next one.
Thank you, Tony, and hopefully we'll do this again when that comes out, whenever that is.
We will.
All right.
How great was Paul? When you stoke us, you're saying, thank you, Tony, for showing us truly good people like Paul doing God's work. You're now the sole heir of my will. So shout out to our Patreons, Nancy Rommelman, Sean Atlow, Matt Mills, Sean Wallace, Greg and Molly, Jamie Taylor, Mark Johnson, Kira Ann, Barney Granke, Ben Welsh, Jen Adams, Trevor Wilson, Bree Wild, Dougie Gyro, Christina Up North, Robin Carey, Adam Shorn, Ben from Down Under, Chris from the ATX, Gregor, and Phil. To be a Patreon, just go to patreon.com/hereinLA. Want to support us, but money ain't really flowing? Totally understood. Just post this episode on your Facebook or on your Twitter or on your Threads or on your Live Journal or on the bathroom wall if you want. It's spelled H-E-A-R in L-A, as in hereinla.com, where all of our episodes live and chill and fraternize and frolic and just look lovely, all thanks to great guests like Paul. So thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.